Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning, as is almost always the case, is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. How you doing, man?
I am doing well, Stone. How was your weekend?
Well, it was good, but a little bit nerve-wracking. My 15-year-old went clubbing.
Clubbing?
You can go clubbing at 15 in this town, and I
really
don't know how I feel about that.
Is that Seals? What kind of clubbing was going on?
It's reportedly what I was told, it was everything but the alcohol.
Really? Sounds a little suspicious.
I know. It's a tough time for me. You know, she's driving with the permit. She's going to the clubs. And it'd be one thing if she was just, you know, dead ugly, but she's not. She's gorgeous and popular and smart, and she's smarter than me. And I'm glad to come to work and get a little bit of rest.
I'm a little frazzled. You didn't do a drop-in? I think I would have done a drop-in.
But maybe I should have. How about you, man? Movies, restaurants? What'd you do?
No, it's a low-key weekend. Nothing happened.
Well, farmer's market. I know you had to go to the farmer's market.
Nothing.
You got to be kidding me.
Had the weekend off.
Man.
Sit back. Did nothing.
You're boring. Let's go
to
our guests.
Dude, let's go to the guests. They have something interesting to say.
Well, this is going to be a great segment. We have a studio full. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from our buddy Andy Katz, who we met at the Calm Serene remote broadcast
when we did
the one at Sweetwater Brewery Company
for TechCrunch.
Yeah. And we're going to hear from a business intermediary. I probably am not pronouncing that right. I know I can't spell it. Kent Reed with Murphy. We're going to talk with Bill Short with FiberTech. But first up, on the High Velocity Radio Show, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce a gentleman with LexisNexis Risk Solution. He's a director of credit risk decisioning, Mr. Ankush Tiwari. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How do we do on the pronunciation?
That was an A+. Very good.
I've been working on it all night.
Yeah, I could tell.
Did he say LexisNexis correct?
He got most of that out correctly.
I would have spelled it wrong, no doubt. Well, we're delighted to have you. Give us a little bit of a feel for you, Will, just an overview of LexisNexis and specifically the Risk Solutions outfit. What are you guys out there trying to do for folks?
Sure. So LexisNexis Risk Solutions is a risk information provider, and we're part of a bigger company called Reed Elsevier, which is a global information and other services company. LexisNexis specializes in risk information for financial services, for insurance, for government, for healthcare, for law enforcement, and we have about $1.5 billion in revenue, and about 4,500 associates all over the world.
Now, are you providing the skinny on individuals, or are you providing information on organizations, or both?
For both. Primarily for individuals, and we have a growing business practice as well.
So how is this different than like Equifax or one of the credit bureaus?
So good question. Very different and in some ways very similar as well. So what I do especially is credit risk decisioning. So what that is information. We provide information to lenders who are using the type of information we bring to make credit decisions on individuals, much like you would at a car lender or a credit card company. And we're very different than what a credit bureau does, just in the type of information we deliver. So a credit bureau has what's called your trade line information. So they have a record of your credit cards and your mortgage and your auto loans that you have open.
Right.
And they know how you pay on those trade lines. And companies use that information, your prior performance on your trade lines, to determine what kind of loan to give you, what kind of rate to give you, and whether to give you a loan at all. And what we do is we add information to that trade line. So just like you would add our information on top of that trade line to make a better decision. So if you were, you know, if you were able to grade a bank's ability to predict credit risk as a 90, you know, just using bureau information, you could add LexisNexis information to it, and then you'd probably grade that bank at a 95. So they make better credit decisions. They have lower losses as a result. And they may be able to approve more customers for loans using our information.
So there are a few institutions in our recent past that probably should have engaged you some time ago, I would think.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, and that's actually a really big reason why our business is growing today, is that banks are looking for ways to make better decisions and lower their losses. So if you look back at the recent real estate and mortgage crisis, I think a lot of banks have realized that had they had more information, had they been doing more due diligence, they could have prevented some of the losses that they now face. And so that's actually one of the big reasons our business is growing.
Does it work both ways? Can you give me information on the bank so I know which banks are going to be good?
Now, that unfortunately is not the case, although it would be great.
So what are some of the data points that you might be able, if you're allowed to share, that you might be able to provide a bank that a typical credit report is not going to reveal and might influence a decision like this?
Sure. So what we have primarily is what we call public record attributes, and we also have other proprietary information sources. Let me start with the public record. The public record is information about you as a consumer that is publicly available from federal, state, local, county governments all over the U.S. So as an example, here in Fulton County, your home value is a matter of public record. You are in the county tax record. They publish publicly available information about you, the fact that you own the property you live in, and what the value of that property is. And actually, in Fulton County, they also publish the value of your mortgage. So anyone can go into the website and look that up, and so that's a matter of public record. We gather that type of information from all 3,154 counties, almost all of them, all over the country, bring it all together. And that is one piece of information that's highly predictive, and it's not really on your credit report. So you can imagine a person's home value says a lot about them, whether they live in a poor neighborhood or a rich neighborhood. It also indicates their ability to repay a loan if things really get dire. That's an asset that they can rely on to pay a loan back. And that's very valuable for any lender. Similarly, we have public record information such as any kind of court information, so any kind of lawsuit, judgments, liens, criminal records, all that sort of stuff is part of our credit report. And when you add that to the Bureau Tradeline report, that gives you that extra level of insight.
Please pay no attention to Baldwin County, Alabama records in the 87 to 90 range.
How far back do you go?
Yeah.
That's a good question. We have couple of decades, three decades sometimes, of information.
Wow. Forget it. You don't stand a chance, Stone.
So you've mentioned banks quite a bit. What other organizations are you serving? Tell us a little bit about your customer base and your sweet spot.
Yeah, the customer base is really diverse. We have customers all the way from top credit card issuers, people who send out millions of offers every month for credit cards, all the way down to buy here, pay here auto dealers who are very small shops and are still looking to do better and make better credit decisions. So we have customers in credit card, in telecom, in auto lending. We're growing a real estate business. We also do deposit accounts, consumer lending.
Is this a service that your prospective client doesn't think they really need? Like they think they have it covered, and that's one of your challenges?
That's a great question as well. So a lot of times,
it wasn't that great of a question.
No, that was
very insightful.
That was very insightful. I have to say that he really got to one of the issues that we face.
Yeah. There's going to be no living with him the rest of the day. Go ahead.
Credit decisioning is kind of an esoteric subject. It's kind of an art practiced by statisticians. A lot of people think that they're doing it right. They think that they've been doing it for decades. They've got the credit bureau information. They've got the bank's own internal information. And they see no real need to add anything to the mix. And so part of our job is to go in and kind of educate them a little bit, and then we actually encourage them to test with us. So we run all kinds of analytic tests to kind of prove to them statistically that, yes, actually our information is different than what you have currently, and it adds a lot of value. And usually after a test, once people see that, yes, they could be making X more millions of dollars in loans, and they would be reducing their losses by another tens of millions of dollars, it's a no-brainer.
Now, does it typically reveal that the person that you're checking out is risk worthy, or it's too big of a risk?
Like it just really depends. I mean, I think the way I think about it, it just helps the lender be more accurate, and whether that's looking at people and if you have a credit bureau score of a FICO score of a 680, sort of on the margin. And really, our data really helps tease apart the 680s that are going to be good credit risks from the 680s that are going to be bad credit risks.
Right.
It really helps differentiate. So you're really going to be more accurate at both ends of the spectrum.
Anything in particular that an individual or a business that might be out seeking capital can do proactively to look more attractive, knowing that there's these more in-depth tools now available to the people that are going to be looking? Is there anything that we can do to be more proactive so that we look better once we run through the LexisNexis filter or the these other filters, or just it is what it is?
Just pay your bills. How about that?
Well, again, that's the second really insightful question that we've gotten on the show. You guys are good. I'm telling you. You guys are taking a subject that not many people know about and just really diving into it. So one of the key differences between our data and some of the bureau data is it's sort of a empirical picture of a person and their electronic footprint as they're kind of conducting their business. So, you know, you're not really going to be able to move the needle on your home's value, right? You're sort of going to be able to afford what you can afford. The credit bureau knows whether you're paying or not. We know what the value of that home is. Similarly, you know, one of these things about address history that's interesting is that we can tell if you are sort of a transient person, right? If you are moving around, if you're couch surfing or changing your address, if you've moved, you know, 10 times in the last 3 years, we'd say, yeah, you're probably transient. You may be a little bit more risky than someone who has a stable address history, someone who's lived in the same house, same address for many, many years. But there's no one thing that could really change your credit score. You know, it really is. Banks don't just look at one element and say, oh, this person's not a good credit risk. They really have to build a full picture of that individual. And so I'd say, you know, you can certainly do things to affect your credit bureau report. You can pay your bills on time, and that'll help. But in terms of the other things that make up a credit history, such as the data that LexisNexis provides, it really is, banks are really looking at the total picture.
Can you imagine being an employee or a prospective employee for LexisNexis? Must be squeaky clean, right?
We do a pretty rigorous screen.
You kind of
got to have a pretty clean history to work here.
So, what's your favorite part of the job, man? And what's a little bit challenging, if not downright frustrating, sometimes?
Oh, that's a good question, too. So I think my favorite part of the job is really getting out there and talking to customers. I have the opportunity sometimes to go visit lenders all over the country. Some of the auto lenders run really interesting businesses. Same thing with the credit card companies, telcos, things like that. So that's really my favorite. The challenging stuff, I'd say it's just like any other big company. It's getting things done internally and, you know, sort of pushing and making sure that my customers are getting taken care of. We always have to, you know, prioritize resources internally, and that's probably the hardest part.
And that engagement cycle, I think you mentioned, often starts with some testing to have some proof of concept. Walk us through the rest of an engagement for a typical high-end customer with you. How does that unfold?
Sure. So typically, you know, we have many people involved in the process. So we have salespeople who will be making contact with the customers and kind of opening them up to the idea of changing their credit risk process. You know, usually these things are locked in for a period of years. They don't really want to change. So the rep goes in and, you know, just really does that education job, opens them up to the possibility that, yes, they could do a lot better. And then we have, if they agree to that, we have several teams. We have a scoring consulting team, and we have statistical modelers who come in and work with their analysts. So, you know, you can imagine it's a lot of really smart people, a lot of PhDs in the room getting together, looking at analytic models and charts and graphs and data and saying, okay, well, what are the real opportunities here for us to get better? So then they'll give us a sample of their data. So they'll look at, we'll look at people who, kind of the total picture, right, of the applicants to their bank. So we'll get a picture of people who came in and applied for a loan or a credit card, the people they accepted, and the people that they declined. And then we'll look at kind of the rates and the limits and all that stuff that they gave them. And then we'll look at the outcome. So this is typically a study that's done 18 months after a population has applied for a loan, because we want to know what happened to those people. So you accepted someone 18 months ago. What happened today? Did they pay well? Or did you have to charge them off at some point within this last 18 months? So Once we have all that information together, then we take our risk view information, that's the product, we take that and we put it onto the test file, and we have our analysts run, you know, pretty complex statistical analysis on it, and then we come back and we give the lender a presentation that shows them the results. And so eventually we're able to boil it down into dollars and cents. You know, we'll be able to say, okay, based on our analysis, we think that you could make X more millions of dollars by approving these many new applicants. We identified this pool of other applicants who you accepted, but you probably shouldn't have. And had you not accepted them back at the time when they came in the door, you would have saved X millions of dollars in charge-offs. And so that really builds the value proposition that we can tell them. You know, for every dollar you spend with LexisNexis data, you're going to get back $7, $8, $10 in new revenue or charge-off savings.
Sounds like these guys know what they're doing.
I think so.
So the very front end of your sales and marketing cycle, if you pick up the phone and say you're with LexisNexis, is that a wide open door, or is it a challenge to get in front of some of these folks sometimes?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. I mean, people know Lexis. People in financial services and insurance, they know LexisNexis for many types of information, not necessarily for credit risk. So that's sort of my specialty is the credit risk information. And that's, you know, that's where we get in and really have done a good job, I think, of educating customers. And so, you know, we're growing 40% plus a year. And so the challenge is there, but I think we're doing some good things, like coming on, you know, this show to get the word out.
Now, do you have a big presence here in Atlanta, or your footprint obviously is national, international, but are you paying special attention to Atlanta?
Well, the Risk Solutions headquarters is in Atlanta. It's in Alpharetta. It's actually the Choice Point business is one of the businesses that LexisNexis bought 4 years ago. So the whole headquarters of the company moved here. We have, I think it's over 1,000 people working in Atlanta. But our focus, our customer operations and our customer base is really nationwide. So, you know, you can imagine, though, there's heavy concentrations in the East Coast. We have a lot of financial services customers, but really we're all over.
Right.
So what's the best way for our listeners to reach out and learn more and have a substantive conversation about some of these topics?
Sure. So, you know, I think the best place to start is at our website, which is www.lexisnexis.com/risk. And just start from there, and you can see all the different products we have to offer, all the different solutions for different markets. And then, you know, search for credit risk, and you can see the product that I have.
Terrific. Hey, listen, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
That's great. Love to.
All right. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, we have a gentleman with FiberTech. His name is Bill Short. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Must have something to do with telecom. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, we're a telecom construction company that focuses primarily in fiber optics.
And that's the glass, right, where the light goes through?
That's the glass. Everything went through copper, and we're trying to send it through the glass. It's much more efficient, much more secure, and it's where the future is for everything that's going on in telecom.
So who all is buying this glass? Are we talking about the big telecom providers? Are we talking about big organizations that want to run glass through the buildings? Or
well, what we're doing is we're working with several different groups. There are people out there, the large carriers, whether it would be AT&T, Comcast, those types that have it. But then there are also a number of independent folks that own fiber optic networks, and they're just out there signing up people to do business with them as opposed to the big people. And then we also work, the universities and colleges are huge users of fiber optics just because of the flow. If you think about telecom, it's really voice, data, and video. And if you think of what's happened in that arena in the last, whether 5 years or 10 years, it's just growing exponentially, the amount of bandwidth that's being required. So what a lot of people don't know is if you look at cell phone towers, for instance, most people think that a call goes to the tower and then it goes from tower to tower through the air. It doesn't. It goes into the ground, and then it goes through fiber, comes out at the tower nearest the end user, and so that's where all the capacity is.
I had no idea. I thought it bounced around from tower to tower.
it would just bump into each other doing that.
Yeah. It'd be a little crowded. Yeah.
Now, how prevalent is fiber optics? Is it everywhere that it needs to be, or is there still more fiber optics, the cables to be laid?
Great question. If you look into the early 2000s, you would read a number of articles that would say that we were oversaturated. And what that meant was that a lot of people went out and laid the trunk lines, the major lines. But what happened was there really wasn't much demand for it. And so until the advent of iPhones and Netflix and businesses like that that really demanded the fiber. So now the trunk lines are out there, but there's a tremendous demand to get all the businesses signed up. Atlanta is actually the fifth largest city in the United States as measured by the amount of bandwidth that's used. This is a very high-tech kind of a city, and so there's a lot of demand here. You go out to whether it's a Birmingham or a Charlotte or a Columbia, South Carolina, the demand is a lot less, and they've got a lot less that's actually in the ground to the end user.
Now, so that it's that last mile that we're still struggling with even today?
That's exactly right. That's where the demand for my business is getting people to that last mile. So we're happy that the demand for all of the bandwidth is still growing at an exponential pace. And if you look at some of the numbers that are projected, it's still projected to grow exponentially. As far as you can see,
not slowing down anytime soon.
Not slowing down. Again, you look at I've got young, relatively young kids, and they're 18 and 20. And if you look at how they communicate and how they are entertained, it's totally different from the way we grew up. And it's all driven through fiber. Thank goodness.
So you didn't have Netflix when you were growing up?
Not hardly.
And you said my business. It is your business. This is your business, yes?
This is my business. I was I'm a recovering banker. I was a banker for 34 years, and
I saw you nodding your head a lot while we were talking to Ankush.
Well, I thought it was really interesting on the LexisNexis side. I think the interesting thing about business is the bank's interest margins are so thin that anything that you can any hundredths of a basis point that you can pick up in his business really does right. make a big difference to the bank. So yes, but I retired from the banking business. I just got overwhelmed or just tired of all the regulation that was going on. I was the president and CEO of a bank, but I had all the regulators and the bank was doing fine, but I just decided I wanted to go do something different. And while I was the president and CEO, I didn't own the bank, and I decided I wanted to go do something different.
And you found somebody to help you out with that, and that's our other guest this morning. And this is Kent Reed with Murphy Business and Financial Corporation, Georgia, North Atlanta region. Welcome to the show, man.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for getting this guy gainfully employed or gainfully making some money. Tell us a little bit about Murphy, and then let's talk with both of you about how this thing came together.
Okay. Murphy Business and Financial Corporation is a nationwide firm that helps people buy and sell businesses. So you can take that from small to medium market. And we are in Canada as well. We have over 300 agents and brokers across the country, and we do business valuations as well as machining or equipment valuations, as well as, you know, basically helping people find what they're looking for.
That must be fun to come in and tell an entrepreneur that his baby's not worth as much as he thinks it is, right?
Yeah, that's
is that your job?
One of my favorite things, right?
Because you work both sides of the table, yes?
That's right, both buyer and seller. Uh-huh. And that is one of our most difficult things, is valuing someone's business that they put 10 or 12 or 15 years into, and their multiple is always two or three times more what ours is. So.
Now, what was it like? How did you guys get together? Now, you were at a bank. Were you working, and then you're like, hey, let me call Kent, or how did that all kind of happen?
Well, no, I had actually retired from the bank and was just taking it easy for a while and realized that wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Like, how much golf and fishing can you do?
Exactly. And so I decided...
Well, jet fuel's expensive.
But I decided I wanted to get out and buy a company, and that's a pretty big world out there. And I happened to be talking to a friend and said I was interested in talking to a broker, and it was a mutual friend, and he said, hey, give Kent a call. And candidly, I had spoken with several other brokers. Business brokers come in all shapes and sizes, and a lot of them work out of the, you know, out of the basement of their home, and you know, they might know of somebody who's interested in selling a company. So I interviewed three, and the fact that Kent brought such a much bigger approach to the world, because they do have a national franchise and they have people that are experts in whether it's franchise or non-franchise, and they just have access to a lot more companies from my perspective. And so,
but isn't that difficult? You had like kind of a blank slate. You could have chose any business. You could have chose a franchise. There was a kind of infinite amount of choices. How did you kind of get narrowed down into what you chose?
Well, that's a great question, because most people would say the business that you're going into, you need to have a real passion for it. And if you looked at me and say, hey, do you have a passion for fiber?
Maybe not. Since you were a kid, you dreamed one day of being the fiber king. Right.
That was it. But as a banker and a finance guy, I have a passion for cash flow. And so,
it's all about math.
It is about the math. But so I talked to Kent, and I wrote down the attributes of a company that I was looking for, and about how much I wanted to spend and what kind of cash flows I needed, what kind of investments I was going to have to need. But when you're buying a company, if you bought an HVAC company and you're going to go in and own it, you probably better be an HVAC technician, because that's who's going to do the work and make the money for you. So as you look at that, you have to decide, are you going to be the principal provider of the service that's out there? And I certainly didn't know anything about fiber, and I didn't want to do that. So you have to, when you're looking to buy the company, you have to look at your people and see how good they are. And on the second day when you walk into the office, are they going to be there as well? And then you also look at your customers, and how dependent is your customer base on the previous owner? Or if they say, hey, the company is changing CEOs, I can change and go to another company. So how loyal are they? Do you have contracts? And so you just have to look at those things and look at the things that you're really good at and what you can bring to the table, and then look at what all the other people bring to the table. Because I didn't really want to start up a company. That was at my stage in life. I was looking to buy more of an existing company that maybe needed some more capital, or somebody just wanted to sell the company for whatever reason.
Now, Kent, you must have a pretty thorough vetting assessment process when you're trying to figure out, hey, I think one of the things that I'll talk to Bill about when he comes back by is fiber tech. How do you make those decisions?
And that's a great question. And Bill mentioned one of the things that's a big advantage with Murphy Business and Financial is that we are full-time brokers. So we're not brokering in the evening. We're not brokering on the weekends. So it is our life. Most of us are ex-directors or CEOs or vice presidents of companies and have gone on to do something that we wanted to do. So when in this particular case with Bill, I had the sell side of the equation. So I had the business listing as well, but Murphy has a good process that is constantly evolving over the years with our clients on how do we best serve the buyer and the seller. In Bill's particular case, we put him through a number of questions to try and find out, again, ascertain what he was looking for. And you may not know when you first start. Bill mentioned he's a banker. You would not have thought that he would end up with a number of splicing trucks and know how to splice fiber optic cables. He probably still doesn't, but that's not the point. Well, you know, we kind of work backwards and say, well, what is it you need to make?
Right.
You know, and what kind of assets do you have and what are you willing to put into it? And then we go to the skills assessment part.
Right. I would think that Bill's like a dream client because he cares about the math of this. And as long as you have a good thing that makes financial sense to him, that he's probably almost there.
Bill is, at the risk of sounding odd, is a dream client because he understands the numbers, and the numbers are very important. Many people don't, believe it or not. So we spend a lot of time going through cash flow and what that means and how do we get it and how do you keep it and how do you grow it. Bill knew that whole side of the equation. So our job was made much easier in just finding him the right business that he could apply his math to.
Right. Now, how many times do you have a client that's like, you know, I love ice cream, so I want to get an ice cream. You know, it's like, you know, they have this dream as a kid that they imagine themselves in, you know, in some weird business like yogurt or ice cream, where maybe that's not the right fit for them at that stage of their career?
Well, that's interesting. Almost never do we have someone that says, I want to do this. Uh-huh. Because they come, when you get to be a certain age, you come with a lot of educational and a lot of skills that may have steered you towards a certain course. For instance, Bill might have thought many other things that were banking related, but we found him something that's completely outside of that field that he can still apply a lot of his skills
right.
to.
So you have to. So the your client, Kent, has to be kind of open-minded.
Absolutely.
Now, Bill, when you were doing this, did you think you'd land on something banking related? Was that your instincts, or no, you were open-minded?
No, I was open-minded. Again, the banking business, you've got to have 30, 40, 50 million in capital. If you're going to own a bank, if you will. So I really thought that I'd probably take a 90-degree turn and go do something just totally different, but something that, again, would need good management, good numbers, capital that I could invest in the company. So I was open-minded.
Did you narrow it down? Was this amongst the choice, or you just found this?
It was
one
this or yogurt.
Yeah. No, well.
Fancy yogurt, man.
Well actually, Kent.
Or hamburgers.
Yeah. Kent just started showing me deals. And so, I looked at a debt collection agency. I looked at a document shredding company. I looked at a Christmas decoration installment business. I looked at a number of different businesses as we went through. And Kent one day said, I got something. You probably wouldn't be interested in this. It's, it's in fiber optics.
That's his go-to line.
That's right.
Well, that's in my pocket. And he said, you probably don't know anything about it. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, back in the late 70s, I helped finance the leveraged buyout of a fiber optic manufacturing company. So I at least knew what it was. And so I said, well, tell me a little bit about it. And he did. And we just... again, the attributes were all just lined up, and it was an interesting process, but it was something that I was very pleased to have somebody like Kent kind of working through it with me, because the greatest value comes, as he says, most people think their business is 2, 3, 4 times worth that much more money than it is. They're really pretty baby. Coming out of the economy we've been in, nobody's been showing great numbers. And so, it's got to be a win-win situation in my book. And so I just wanted to find something that was a good business. And it's helpful that the broker has sort of set the tone on the other side about what's realistic to look for. And again, it's also when you're negotiating, sometimes when you ask a question of somebody, they get a little, they think you're accusing them of something. And because what you're trying to find, what you want to make sure is that you've got good information to make a decision with. And so when you ask somebody about, well, tell me about this, they're like, are you accusing me of whatever? And so having a broker in between really is quite helpful. And it either he can ask a question or he can at least set the tone for the others when those questions need to be asked.
Now, when you decided to go for this business, how long did it take you to complete the deal?
Gosh, we probably, from the time that I looked at it was probably 5 or 6 months. So, candidly, that was actually a very quick process.
Uh-huh. So you were comfortable with that time frame? Like everything moved at a speed you were comfortable with?
It did for me, yes. I was ready. I think probably the most important thing, and probably one of the questions that Kent always asks is, now, really, tell me how much money you can spend, and where's that money coming from? And so, again, being the banker, I knew how much money I had to invest. I knew what I was going to do, because there are lots of different avenues, whether you've got your own cash, whether you use your IRA or 401k, whether you have other investors, family, friends, whether you get financing from a bank, whether you get financing from the SBA, whether you get owner financing, or all of the above, or some combination. So, somebody comes in and says, hey, this is a great company, and Kent says, okay, you ready to write the check? And the guy goes, let me
talk to my brother-in-law.
Yeah, let me go see what I can dig up. So again, being the banker, that was very important to me to say, okay, this is how much I've got. I've already talked to my banker. I know how much they'll lend me whatever I need. So, you've got to be realistic about it, because that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's what's going to make the transaction
happen or not.
Kent, is it a buyer or seller market right now in your arena?
Right now, we have a lot of buyers looking, and sellers, as Bill said, have been beat up a lot through the economy. But there are some still some great businesses out there, as we touched on a little bit. You know, it's not just hamburgers and ice cream and yogurt that's out there. There are a lot of ways to make money, as Bill said, anywhere from Christmas tree decoration lights to porta potties to whatever. So although we have a lot of buyers out there, there are still some good businesses. But I think the economy has dented a number of those businesses. So it's important to take a look at those and understand what's happened to them.
Now, do you have any tips for the business owner to make their business more attractive to sell? I mean, at what point should a business owner start thinking about selling and getting everything looking good for the sale?
The best way to go about that is 3 years out, because we normally look at 3 years tax returns, and then we're going to dig through those financial due diligence on those numbers. But they can start getting their numbers in line. If they are a cash business, or some of their business is a cash business, as much as they don't want to report it, report it, pay your taxes. And that gives a way for people to go back and track where that money came from and where it's going. Mm-hmm. So you start 3 years out, clean up your books and records, get those ready. And then if you're a retail type operation, then get your store looking better, you know, clean it up, move out the excess baggage, that type of thing.
Now, Bill, you mentioned IRA or 401k as one place to go get the money, and I guess I'll ask you and or Kent, can you do that without penalty? And if so, is it a good idea, or do you have an opinion on that?
Well, you can do it, and you can do it without penalty, but you have to be very careful with the IRS, and you have to just dot all your I's and cross your T's. Probably the biggest drawback to doing it is that if you ultimately sell your company, that money, the profit of the transaction goes into your IRA, and so when you take your money out of the IRA, it's going to come out at a regular tax rate as opposed to a capital gains rate. So it's ordinary. It shows up basically as ordinary income. So you would want to just take a look at that and say, you know, is that really what I want to do? And again, you can just, if it might be a part of the transaction, but it's something that you would definitely need outside counsel on doing. And when you're doing your due diligence, make sure you've got an appropriate opinion from your tax attorney. And also, it'd probably be a good idea to do it with somebody who's done a lot of them, as opposed to somebody who says, I think we can do this.
Right. I'll read the IRS manual and I'll walk them right through it.
We've got a number of people using that option right now, only because they may have come out of corporate and they've got, say, $50,000 in cash, and they say, well, what kind of business can I buy? So we're back to the yogurt stand for $50,000. However, they may have $500,000 in a 401k plan that they can tap and use.
So there are times when it's perfectly appropriate, but just do the due diligence and work with a seasoned professional who knows what they're doing.
Right, and we have those professionals, third-party professionals, that can help you do that.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the difference between a business broker and maybe a franchise broker?
Well, they're the same. The difference...
He started to say ethics, and then he pulled
out. I did. A franchise broker is a business broker in some aspects. In the state of Georgia, you have to be a licensed real estate agent to actually sell an existing business.
Oh, wow.
Really? A real estate agent to be a business broker?
How
yes,
about that?
That's the only way that the state of Georgia has.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Right. So Murphy Business is a little different in that there's a lot of training that you go through on top of those regulations. But the franchise broker can buy and sell new franchise or sell new franchises without having that type of license, but they cannot sell an existing business.
Right. So you specialize on businesses, not franchises?
Murphy Business does both. We have a list of over 100 franchises that we are pre-approved to resell or sell. The difference with a business intermediary is that he can resell an existing franchise.
Right.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
Now, you guys get on our screen through a public relations professional, and I'd be interested to hear about the decision to engage a PR firm and a little bit about how that works.
Okay, most of our business is word of mouth or referrals, like Bill was referred to me, and you know my goal is to have Bill as a repeat customer and a friend long term. So it's not most people buy or sell a business one or two times in their life. So you need the referrals and you need the word of mouth to get new business. Our PR firm helps us do that by coming on shows like yours and others to get the word out about what we do and how we do it, and gives people the opportunity to talk to us and see if they might want to make a life change.
So, Bill, how's Kent doing?
He's doing a great job.
He the dream broker for you?
So how did you go about making your choice for a PR firm? I mean, that's an important choice. I mean, if that relationship...
Is that a Murphy choice, or did you choose them?
It's Roger Murphy, who is our CEO, brought them in, and then we had the opportunity to use them or not. And Jamie Isaacs out of Chicago is great at what he does. He used to live in the Atlanta market, so he knows a lot of people, and he's an overall good PR firm, in my opinion. So,
mm-hmm. So that worked out nicely for you then.
It has. Yeah.
And for us, too. It gives us top caliber guests.
There you go.
So I want to make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you. We'll start with you, Bill, if you could provide some contact information for our listeners.
And who is the person you want to reach out to you? Is it me at my house? I want fiber in my house, or my business? Who's your dream client?
Well, our dream clients are typically those people that own the large fiber networks and who are going to build them. So they're really not that many folks that are out there doing that. So we're doing business with most of the folks in the metro Atlanta area. Uh-huh. If we were going to reach out, we would reach out in the other cities around the southeast. But candidly, our business is we're doing pretty much all we can handle and
right
making additional investments. Our website is fibertechatlanta.com. If you want to go find out a little bit more about us or interested in employment opportunities, we'd love to talk to you. It's a great business. It's certainly a growing business. And we just appreciate, or I appreciate, what Kent was able to do for me in finding this great business.
Sounds like a fun place to work. I think that'd be a good, solid, fun place to work. Are you looking for anything specific right now, or do you know?
Well, the interesting thing is that we are generally working on live networks, and so most of our work is done between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m.
Uh-huh.
So if you're interested, it sounds like you're probably not, you know, doing this radio gig that time of night. So if you're looking to moonlight, we'd love to put you out there in a truck and splicing fiber.
Maybe just don't run me through the LexisNexis filter.
Yeah.
Or instead of clubbing, perhaps your daughter could go.
Yeah, there you go.
Now we have a plan. We'll talk after the show. Well, thanks so much. And Kent, definitely the folks in the Atlanta market, they need to know about you and have a way to get in touch with you.
Yes, Atlanta or Georgia, anywhere in Georgia. You can reach us and go to our website at www.kentreed-murphy.com or k.reed@murphybusiness.com is the email address.
Now, are you looking for buyers or sellers, or both at all times?
Both. Right now, we've got a very strict process on our buyers because we want the right people to put into the right places. But buyers or sellers or people who need a machinery and equipment appraisal or evaluation on their business, give us a call.
Now, is that a good practice for business? Like you mentioned, like I'm going to sell in 3 years. So is that something I should be doing, is getting a business valuation, maybe to get a baseline so that I know where I have to go and maybe you can help me?
Exactly. And that helps start that reality check.
Right.
And if you start it 3 years out, of course, it's going to change a little, but it at least puts you in the ballpark and it gets you understanding where you're going to be 3 years from now.
Right. And the website again?
Is www.kentreed-murphy.com.
All right, Kent, how about hanging with us while we visit with our last guest?
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Well, next up and last up, bringing it all home for us on High Velocity Radio today, Lee, is the guy that we met out there at TechCrunch, and we did our best to conduct an interview in that environment. It was a lot of fun doing that remote broadcast, and we look forward to
it. It was just loud.
It was just a little
and
bit.
And we're old.
And we are old. But please welcome back to Radio X, and welcome back to our microphone, Mr. Andy Katz with Thumb Friendly. How you doing, man?
Great. Thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
Can you hear us now?
I can hear you. I can hear everything. It's great.
Was that the loudest event you've ever been to?
Probably.
Was it a good event for you? Did you enjoy it?
Great event. Great networking. Learned a lot about other companies in Atlanta. The VC scene was in town that night. Sig Mosley was there. So it was a very interesting evening.
I know people were walking around, Sig Mosley and Stone Payton are here.
Right. That's or Stone Payton and Sig Mosley.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit about Thumb Friendly, man. What's happening over there?
So Thumb Friendly, we've been around about a year now almost. Not even a year. But you just... FiberTech Atlanta, you just told people to go to his website, right?
Yes.
And Trenton over here in the corner just pointed to me and said, "It's not mobile. It's not mobile."
Trenton's always on the job, man.
So
now it's a lead for you.
We'll do it for free for these guys. I like them. Very likely, though, your listeners are CEO level people, you know, very influential in the business community, and they probably went to look at his website on their mobile device, and guess what? You could barely see it. You had to pinch and zoom. So what we do, what ThumbFriendly does, we do three things, really. We create great mobile experiences via a thumb site, a mobile website. Then we advertise our clients on Google. We're a Google-certified partner on the advertising side. So we make sure that our clients come up on the front page of Google Mobile when someone does a search for them.
And that's different than regular Google?
That's different than regular Google. The main difference that our clients love is the cost per click on a mobile device is about 65% less expensive than a desktop device. However, if you're on a mobile device, you're at the bottom of the buying funnel. You're more likely to make an action, whether it's a phone call or visit the store or make an appointment. So we're in a great time right now for what we do because all the like he knows, he's laying wires and all that. A lot of people are using mobile devices to access the web. And then third is we track everything. We care. We don't really care about clicks for our clients. We care about new business. So we have a program called ThumbTrack where we record every phone call we bring our clients. They love that for three reasons. Number one, it shows that our advertising on Google is working. Number two, we can track any other marketing, any other media mix. We put a local phone number or if they want a national phone number. And we know after 30 days, our clients know what media mix they're spending on is bringing the ROI.
Oh, that's got to be helpful.
Very powerful for these small and medium businesses. Our average client is an SMB. 80% of our clients are small and medium business owners. And it's very powerful because it's if they know that the Business Chronicle ad is working, they're going to spend more money there. If they know this is working, they're going to spend more money there. If they know a radio, whatever. So you guys understand the point there. Also, it's great for quality control. We have an example. Our clients can hear the calls. And, you know, they get a call, they transfer it five times, they can hear the entire call. We had an example of a surgeon about 2 months ago where the first Thursday, this surgeon practices at 3 o'clock on Thursdays at Northside Hospital. So the first Thursday, he was on ThumbTrack. At 3:09, the answering service picked up. We didn't say anything to him. The next Thursday at 3:15, we noticed the answering service pick up. So I called him personally. I know that he was one of my clients originally. And I said, "You have a problem with your staff." He goes, "No, I don't. They're loyal. They've been me with 15 years, cats. They know what they're doing." I said, "Go back to your office after you sew her up." He went back about 3:55. He couldn't get in. Closed, lights off.
Ooh, ouch.
So that's another reason why ThumbTrack is very important.
So you got this thing started on your own. You've been going for how long?
We're in our 11th month now. Raised some startup money about 11 months ago, and we have two or three institutional groups looking to play with us now. So
it's exciting times.
It's exciting times right now.
So you're looking to sell? I got somebody.
Yeah,
we
got them in.
Not looking to sell yet.
So when you don't have Lee and Stone teeing up brand new clients
right.
for you,
really? I love it.
How do you go get them? Are they coming?
We have
to
a
you?
Direct. There's a lot of competition in the space, but nobody with a direct face-to-face sales force. And we've built out a great sales force over the last 11 months. So we call them mobile business advisors, MBAs.
I like it.
You like that?
That's no accident.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
That's a coincidence.
So we're direct. We're feet on the street. You know, we're using our networks that they have. And, you know, it's anybody can be a client right now. I just read how I got started in this is about 11 and a half months ago, I have major ADD. That's what created the business. And I was driving, and I realized I left my wallet at home about 2 miles from my house. I kept going. Didn't need it. The next week, I was about 15 miles from my house and realized I left my cell phone. I rushed back home to go get it. And then literally 3 days later, Wall Street Journal came out with a report that Apple last year sold more iPhones in 1 year in operating 1 year than they did 30 years of selling anything else, max. Very, very powerful data. Literally 5 days later, Wall Street Journal came out with another article. You can tell I read the Wall Street Journal from time to time, that Google predicts by the end of this year, more people, 50% of people will access a website from a mobile device and 50% from a desktop device. Very powerful data.
So what's it been like courting that money? Has it been fun, a little bit frustrating? What's that
They're
like?
They're probably throwing money at you, yeah. Right?
No, not. I'm learning every day. I learn something new. It's great. I have a great advisory team.
You had a full head of hair when you started.
I did. Those are the two little girls I have and the wife. So, no, but courting money has been very challenging but interesting. There's great money out there, and then there's bad money. So what we're looking for now is smart money, right? Somebody that could come in the business and also help manage and run the business. And we want that type of money, that someone's going to be involved. And all the groups looking at us now they're very smart money.
Now, when you're communicating the benefits to a potential client, are there industries you're targeting, or is it kind of the Wild West? You'll take anybody that has a phone and a website?
Great question. I read a report last week that less than 5% of businesses, national brands, small, medium businesses are mobile optimized. So it is the wild, wild west right now. Our focus is on the small and medium business owner, the plumber down. Go ahead.
But how are you defining that small and medium? That's like everybody.
Right. Companies that spend over $5,000 a year on advertising. So we don't want to go after anybody that doesn't spend that much.
And then, so you identify them through, I guess, some sort of list service or you have some way to find those people out, and then you got your crew out there knocking on doors?
Exactly. Also, the crew, the people, our MBAs are very, they're not right out of college, per se. They built a great network over the last 5 to 10 years.
Right.
So they're out doing their own prospecting as well. So, exactly.
So they're going out there and walk us through, like, say you wanted to sell me on a mobile solution. How would you approach Business Radio X?
So first we would do it to see if you have a mobile site, and I haven't done that yet. I apologize.
On us? Really? You've met us twice.
Right. I've been so busy.
He's trying to raise real money.
Okay, look.
No, so
I'm sure your guy's doing it right now.
He's going on it right now. He can't even access it in here. I think he needs the Fiber Tech Atlanta technology in this office complex.
We block all cell service here, so you're focused on the interview.
I love it. Yeah, so basically we would look at your market, you know, what you do, how you make money.
Uh-huh.
And for you, it's a little different because your customers are your audience, right?
Okay, we'll go with that.
I would imagine. So you want to always give a great experience to your listeners.
Right.
So right now, can your listeners hear you on a mobile device?
On TuneIn. Does that count?
Do they all have that app on their iPhone? Probably
ones that
not.
Have it are listening.
Right. So if you were our customer, we would make sure that from an iPhone or an Android, any mobile device, that they could hear you pretty easily and they wouldn't have to fumble around with the phone.
Right.
That's very important. We're also working on something that's getting ready to come out pretty soon, which is a mobile ad network. This is where you might be a better client. So say you're out, you're a college kid, you just graduated college, mom and dad are in town, you're looking for an apartment in Atlanta.
Right.
Right? So what does that mean? You might be moving. So on the mobile website of this apartment complex, we could have an ad from Bulldog Movers.
Ah.
Right? So we can localize it and target it to the local community where we are. So that's very powerful. That's the next product we're going to have.
So if we had someone listening to the real estate show, maybe we could have an ad for a lender.
Right. It would be specific to whatever the topic is.
Right.
Only if they were approved by LexisNexis.
Exactly. Of course. Yeah, you got to jump through some
hoops. We don't go anywhere without that.
Right. Exactly. No, you got it. Exactly. So a lot of smart, large brands can do this right now, and it costs a lot of money, but we're going to make that product and that solution a lot less expensive and affordable and bring it to the local business.
That sounds exciting. Anything else new? Let's go further out.
Sure.
3, 4, 5 years from now, how do you see the space and how do you see you guys?
Will there be mobile devices or we'll just think things and they just happen?
It changes weekly. 3 to 5 years is a very, very long time, and we're a startup now. So I'm a big believer with success comes choices. So we'll have to see where we are. I don't know. Maybe we'll call Mr. Murphy over here.
It'll be done yourself.
Right.
What about you have favorite mobile apps you like?
You know, I was in the Highlands this weekend on vacation with the family, and I'll tell you, my oldest has been getting up at around 5:30 every morning, climbs into bed, and thank God I found this piano, Magic Piano app.
Uh-huh.
She can play that for 2 hours. So business apps, I haven't really found a really good business app. Bloomberg's good, but it's by Smule. It's this Magic Piano app. If you have young children, they will be engaged, and they will learn for these 2 hours also. But what's interesting, you asked that question about my favorite app. Most people download an app one time, iPhone and Android, and never use it again.
Right.
Right? So we make sure our clients have a mobile website, not an app, but a mobile site.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of your favorite apps, guys?
Words with Friends.
Yeah.
I use Yelp a lot when I travel.
Right, exactly.
We need like apps for our stuff, right? Where like, people can hear our shows.
Right, and each host can have their own.
That would be cool to have that.
How about a mobile site for each host, not even an app?
Okay, you work on that.
We could do both.
Yeah.
We'll have it. Trenton, get to this right now, okay, buddy?
I thought that's what he was working right. on really? Back here. Where do you get your inspiration? Do you have a mastermind group? Are you an avid reader? Where do you get
right.
your ideas? Because you're trying to, you got a lot of plates spinning, getting this thing off the ground.
I'm most proud of the team that we've assembled over the last year. So very smart. I'm a big believer in the human factor is what's going to drive the business. And we have a hell of a smart team that's very helpful. The inspiration comes from a lot of reading, doing. I'm a user of a mobile phone every day, right? I think we all go to bed with it next to us probably.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's my alarm clock.
So just reading about the space. One of my favorite blogs is TechCrunch, and as a startup entrepreneur, I read that every 5 hours. I always learn from that blog. It's just living every day inspires me to find better products and services.
Now, how did you build that team? How did you find people? Like, you had the idea, and then now you had to cobble together some other people that had to believe in it as much as you did. How did you do that? Because that's one of the challenges as a business owner that I know we struggle with is to get people as passionate as us.
Lee keeps firing them.
Right. Mean,
yeah. Got a short attention span too, you know.
Exactly. So, no, great question. I would say two main reasons. Number one, or two main ways, is I built a pretty solid network over the last 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you use my network. But more importantly, we have a great board of advisors. And they know what we're doing. They're involved and they're engaged with the company. And they've teed up some really heavy hitters for us.
So now, how did you get that board of advisors? You went to somebody. At one point, it was just you and an idea, right?
Correct.
So you had to go to somebody and get them to believe, too. So how did that conversation go?
So it's interesting. So our first five clients, this was like a little lifestyle business, the first five clients. They
right.
were all doctors, medical practices. And I said, let's test this and see if it works, see if we can bring in new patients at a low cost per acquisition. And it worked for every one of them. Not
oh,
BSing
wow.
you. Not BSing. It worked for every one of them. So they said, we need to take this from a lifestyle business to a real business. And they started putting people together. I started putting people together. And that's how it really started happening.
So you came up with the idea and you were doing creating the mobile websites?
We were creating the mobile websites, custom, and we were also advertising them on Google Mobile AdWords.
Mm-hmm.
I love talking to startup guys. I mean, that's why I like hanging out with the TechCrunch folks, the Startup
right.
Lounge, the Startup
Riot. Right.
I mean, just so much energy and pet. You would never know that these folks are out there if you watch the news. It all sounds like doom and gloom.
Right.
You can really get re-energized when you hang out with right. people like Andy. I mean, you're on fire, man. You're having a good time.
It's
right?
that jolt y'all had me drinking in the waiting room out there.
it was the espresso and the jolt, absolutely. So how can folks reach out, learn more, and maybe get to visit with Trenton here and get a good mobile site
Absolutely.
Going?
So our website is thumb-friendly.com, and it's also mobile, of course, if you want to look at it now. And then if you want to reach out, you can call us in Atlanta at 404-447-7715, and we'll do a deal right now. How about that?
There you go.
Can we do a deal?
The
daily deal
maker. Absolutely. Lay it out.
Let's say the first 10 people to call, we'll do it for 35% off.
Oh, baby.
So they usually cost about $1 million.
Okay.
So the banker over here is doing the numbers right now. So,
and they got to pass through LexisNexis. And
exactly.
Then right.
Exactly.
Read the fine print, but
right.
It's a deal
35%
today,
off. It's a great deal. We want to help your listeners get more clients and be mobile optimized.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Andy Katz, with Thumb Friendly.
Thanks.
Man, I'm worn out, man. It's a lot
I
of
know,
smart
that's
folks
like,
today.
That's like a job.
Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor and our guests this morning, Ankush Tiwari, Bill Short, Kent Reed, Andy Katz, and our entire Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.